Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming to the Foreign Correspondents Club today. I'm Keith Bredge with the New York Times. I'll be your host today. Before I introduce our guest, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. Please, everybody, turn off your cell phones now. Please, everybody, check them. Make sure they're at least on silent. You shouldn't be embarrassed to look at it now to see if you haven't already turned it off, but if you don't turn it off and it goes off, particularly later since we've got the cameras going, we will embarrass you. So we want you all to turn them off now. Second of all, I'd just like to very briefly mention a couple of our upcoming speakers. Next Wednesday, we have Larry Lipscher speaking, a prominent accountant. He will be speaking on the very broad changes that the United States has adopted in the last few months for taxation of overseas Americans. And that has not really gotten a lot of attention here, but certainly whether it's our American members or people who are interested in accounting and tax issues, Larry Lipscher is a very engaging, lively speaker. I think you'll all enjoy him. The following Monday, we have Hong Kong's Privacy Commissioner, Alan Cheng, speaking, and that should be very interesting as well, given some of the recent interest in, for example, how the company managing our Octopus cards has managed the consumer data. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, Vincent Chan. Many of you know him from having read or seen his reports over the past 7 years at Credit Suisse. Prior to that, he was at UBS. With that, I'd like to introduce him. Here he is. Thank you.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you, Keith, for introducing me. I have to tell all of you that I'm very nervous. Despite I make many speeches before, but before that, I never make a speech that people need to pay to come to listen to me. So, you know, in the past, when I make a speech, they usually are also providing free lunch, so people are okay, well, whatever. But now, it seems that you need to pay for it. Seems to, well, I'm a bit nervous that you may not feel it's very worthwhile. That's my concern, but anyway. Let's get into it as a form of discussion. Today, the topic I talk about is China in 2015. This presentation is based on a research report our research team has produced in the beginning of this year. Basically, it's in view of the Chinese government's 5-year plan, etc., and how we see a lot of the economic development could potentially happen in the country. And you know that when you say about China in 2015, that kind of presentation. The good news is that before you approve right or wrong, people will forget about it, forget what you said. The best thing is that you are almost certainly wrong in some aspect. Because when things are so far ahead, you more or less can only paint a certain scenario. And usually, things will always happen and totally distort your entire scenario. You know, I told my colleagues today, 3 months ago, nobody had predicted Egypt. Nobody can predict Egypt's stock market will close down for a month. So these kind of things, a lot of things are basically out of the forecast of economists, analysts, etc. So definitely, this is not an, if people, you want to hear something like people saying something out of the box, this is definitely not an out of the box presentation. It's more or less like a scenario. If something happens, something will happen. That type of thing. Now, the title of this report we highlight is called From the Gilded Age to the Progressive Era. Well, what does it mean? To a certain extent, I like to draw the analogy of the Chinese economy and Chinese society with a similar experiences of the United States about 100 years ago, and correct if I'm wrong, because I think many of you have much better knowledge about US history than me do. But anyway, based on my understanding, the situation is like this. In around 1860s, after the US Civil War, basically at that time, the whole country was very much in a growth-driven model. People want to make money, very strong social consensus to redevelop the country for growth, etc. And at that time, particularly to the end of the Gilded Age period, there were quite a lot of social issues start to come along, labor rights, food security, these kind of things. And then you have the Progressive Era, which the concern shift to more social harmony, social equality, that kind of consideration. To a certain extent, you could say that the Chinese society, similar after a trauma, 1970s, Cultural Revolution, basically, the country was nothing after the Cultural Revolution. And then there was a very strong social consensus from 1980 till in the last 30 years, growth. There's growth and wealth accumulation. That was the strongest social consensus in China. But you can also see that China probably also developed to an extent that in the last few years, no matter from a government point of view or from a society point of view, they are more concerned about social welfare, social equality, labor rights, food security, that kind of things. So in a way, there are similar society development. You could draw the comparison between these two. So I think that's probably an interesting thing to look. And in that exercise, we try to look back at history and try to see what kind of changes in variable we have seen during that time, what could potentially happen in China in the next couple of years. And then what we did is that we try to be commercial, we need to do one step more further, is that, okay, what sector will be benefit? Because otherwise, then there's no point in publish the report from a broker. So we also look at the development of China's various sectors versus the overall national economy, and try to, using that information, to try to forecast a size of a various market. And at the end, despite I say that I'm only painting one scenario, but at the end of the day, I have to say that, okay, what could get me wrong? What could be make the whole scenarios totally wrong? Now, firstly, let's sketch the overall Chinese economy in this way. Basically, very simple. We expect in the next 5 years, China's economic growth roughly about 9%, real GDP growth 9%, real GDP growth, inflation about 5% per annum. So a still reasonably high GDP growth by China standard and high inflation by China standard. That's our basic core of the economy. Okay, you know that this kind of scenarios basically is implicitly assuming that there's no financial crisis, because one financial crisis often will go. Does it mean that I definitely know that or forecast that China will have no financial crisis in 5 years? Frankly speaking, more that I don't know. These kind of things is difficult to forecast. So in a way, you could say that when we say that China's 9% real GDP growth and 5% inflation, we are kind of implicitly assuming that China don't have a major financial crisis happen in the next 5 years. Later on, in the risk section, I will highlight, okay, what could be the risks that could make this scenario wrong. And at the same time, well, China will also, we will also expect some kind of mild appreciation of the currency, 5%, 3 to 5% per annum, that kind of appreciation. Okay, this is the broad economic picture. Within the broad economic picture, I think the most aggressive prediction we made here is that we actually think that wage growth will be faster than the GDP growth even under that scenario. Now, what does it mean? If you assume 9% real GDP growth and 5% inflation, you basically are assuming a nominal GDP growth of around 14 to 15%. If your wage growth is faster, than we actually expecting the normal wage growth to be something like 18 to 19% per annum. Now, I will explain later why this is the case. So in this analysis, we actually expect the wage income as a percentage of GDP at the moment is quite low. It's probably below 50%, around that level, to be significantly increased in the next 5 years. Accordingly, private consumption as a percentage of GDP will also increase. I think the government in its structural adjustment had put quite a strong emphasis on income and consumption. And to a certain extent, our report thinks that that structural adjustment is achievable. I will explain later why we think this is the case. But however, another structural adjustment, which we think is more difficult to achieve, another structural adjustment is the investment to GDP. China, you know, when you talk about structural adjustment, one thing is to increase consumption, and another thing is to reduce investment. Reducing investment is actually quite difficult. We actually expect China's fixed asset investment ratio at the moment is about 46%, which is the highest in the world, will continue to be the highest in the world 5 years down the road. We don't expect it to drop too much. So overall speaking, in that kind of scenario, and on the other hand, we will expect exports growth to be weaker than that of GDP growth. So accordingly, we basically expect domestic demand to be much stronger than external demand in China. And accordingly, in this scenario, 5 years down the road, China's trade surplus will disappear. At the moment, China is a big trade surplus country. 5 years down the road, down to zero. So this is another call of ours. Finally, regarding the budget, at the moment, China's government budget actually looks very strong. In the first 2 months of this year, China's budget's fiscal revenue growth, that means tax income growth, were up 36% year on year, first 2 months of this year. Indeed, in the last 2 years, the tax revenue growth of China were well ahead of the original forecast. So at the moment, they look very good. However, we actually think that by the end of this five-year period, you will start to see China running a pretty large budget deficit, 4 to 5%, that kind of range. In a way, the simple analogy is that the central government at the moment is telling the local government that, okay, you should do more social welfare and cut your wasteful expenditure. In reality, in every part of the world, what will happen is that more social welfare will be done, but the wasteful expenditure will not be cut. So end up the government will have to spend more money. And indeed, quite a lot of things in China at the moment are done in an off-balance sheet basis. So this, like for example, the whole high-speed rail train construction is actually off-balance sheet. The Ministry of Railway using a bond to do it. If you take into account these kind of things, that the debt repayment, all these kind of things, actually the budget deficit in China will become bigger. So I think this is the kind of scenario we are painting for the whole Chinese economy. Okay, this is in this chart you could see that we expect a pretty strong growth in as a percentage of wage, income and consumption of China. Now let me tell you why we think that the wage income growth will look pretty strong. Firstly, the first and most important reason is demographic. In this chart, basically what we did is that we take a snapshot in China for every 5 years. Every 5 years, we calculate the number, we use the number of population aged between 15 to 19, i.e. the group of people that will enter the labor force, minus the population aged between 50 to 54, basically, it's the people that are retiring, and minus the number of new university students that are joining the university. So the gap is basically the pool of people that will be available for either manual work or low-end service work. Now, for your information, the number of new university students in China has increased from around 500,000 in late 90s, about 10 years ago, to 6 million now. So the new university students actually take up quite a lot of labor pool. But you can see the net result in this chart is that in 1990, this group, after doing the calculation, we have a surplus of around close to 80 million people. Now it's zero. It's already zero. 5 years down the road, it will be a deficit of 40 million. Okay, but at the end of the day, usually the way to get out of this problem is that prolong the retirement age. At the moment, I don't assume any prolong of the retirement age. But I think at some point, 5 years down the road in China, whether retirement age need to be prolonged will have to be in the discussion within the Chinese society. Now another factor is government forces, wage increase. Now I think if you observe the news reporting of last year pretty closely, when the Foxconn incidents happened, when the Honda strike happens in Guangdong, quite contrast to 2 to 3 years ago, actually the government are taking a kind of quote-unquote lenient attitude towards the demonstration. Indeed, the whole Chinese media reporting in a very big way. Okay, 3 years ago, you will not expect it to happen if the guy don't arrest, he's lucky. So, but that is this kind of things, in a way, I think the central government also have an incentive to raise the labor negotiation power and raise their wages accordingly. Now indeed, I think if you look back, I just draw some numbers here. If you look back two periods, the US in the left-hand side, in 1910s, which when it's the start of the progressive era, which you start to see labor union, etc., start to develop, Wage income as a percentage of national income is only 53%. Two decades, you go to 1930s, it's 66%, much higher already. Similarly, Korea's labor movement also started at around 1980s. And you can see that similarly, the wage share to GDP also increased quite dramatically. So I think, okay, I don't know whether China will be that dramatic, but it's a reasonable bet to expect the wage income share as percent of GDP will rise if you assume that the government's lenient attitude towards labor, like last year, continue. Indeed, if they want to develop the consumer market, they will likely to continue. Another thing, there's a third reason why we think that wage growth will surpass GDP. There is a more statistical reason than an actual reason. Is like all emerging markets, you will start to see informal wage payment turning into formal wage payment. At the moment, it's still quite common for Chinese companies to pay their workers in the form like consumption coupons, something like that, in order to help their employees to avoid tax, etc. Instead of a formal wage payment, you pay the people in consumption coupon. These kind of things happen even in societies like Hong Kong 30 to 40 years ago. But generally speaking, emerging market history tells us that gradually, informal wage payment will become as formal wage payment. So companies will increasingly pay you more formal as wage, but cut out other types of informal benefits, etc., those kind of things. I think this is another reason, a statistical reason, that makes a wage to GDP ratio going up. Now, if we follow the trend of, in last 2 years, indeed, China's import growth is already stronger than its export growth. Roughly following this trend, which will be supported by a stronger consumption and investment growth compared to export growth, you should expect China's trade surplus to basically drop to zero in about 5 years' time. This is just a very simple analogy here. So in a way, quite a lot of global imbalances thing itself is going to be settled in a couple of years down the road. Indeed, just in 2006 and 2007, at that time China's trade surplus to GDP is 6 to 7%. Nowadays it's down to 2 to 3% already. Its absolute size is still large, but as a percent of GDP is already shrinking, and it will continue to shrink. First quarter of this year, you may actually see trade deficit in China, but this is a little bit more a blip because of the very suddenly strong increase in commodity prices. About budget, as I mentioned, indeed another analogy. Again, if for those of you who more familiar than me with U.S. history, you might point out I'm wrong, but seems to be the fact that before the Progressive Era, U.S. actually make a pretty decent trade surplus. But once, usually it's like this: when society getting rich, a society start to more care about people. Well, look, you want to care about people, you need to pay. As simple as that. Generally speaking, you will start to see the budget deficit. At the end of the day, government will have to pay out. And at the moment, when China's government deficit at around 2 to 3% of GDP, and with the world's largest reserve requirement, frankly speaking, the government are quite vulnerable to a lot of lobbies about expanding its budget deficit. We will expect in the next 5 years the average budget deficit in China to be reached to 3 to 4%. Now, here it's a little bit tricky. As I mentioned, a lot of things in China at the moment are done in an off-balance sheet basis, i.e., for example, the entire high-speed network, a lot of local government infrastructure. They actually are government spending, but they are not booked as government spending. So in a way, this budget deficit could, whether it will reflect in a formal budget deficit manner or a hidden budget deficit manner, I don't know. But I think in reality, no matter who is doing it, but that gap is rising. Okay, second part is we try to look at the impact of what we talk about on the different sectors in China. Now here, let me explain this chart a little bit. It's a little bit complex chart. What we try to do is to put China into perspective and using United States as a framework of analysis. Now you ask me why US, very simple, is that Chinese leaders always want to compare themselves with U.S. And you see all the mainland think tanks report, they always compare themselves, okay, the U.S. is here, we are here, that kind of thing. And second is that you don't really have that kind of large continental economy, except from U.S. You compare China to Japan. Japan is wealthy, but it's relatively a small country. So anyway, we compare it to U.S. And how to read it is that the y-axis measures at current level, at certain variables, the ratio of China versus U.S., for example. Currently, per capita GDP in China is about $4,000. In the U.S., if I remember correctly, it's about 36,000. So the y-axis, we divide 4,000 by 36,000, so you get about 0.1, something like that. And then we ask ourselves, okay, for the U.S. per capita GDP at $4,000, what is the equivalent year? And the year is 1966. So we see that we plot the GDP chart here, 1966 on the x-axis, and then the 0.1 at the y-axis. And then we try to plot all these things along there. Each variable, the definition is different. For example, bank loans is actually bank loans to GDP. Passenger car penetration is passenger car per person. So we try to put every dot here as a kind of perspective. And it tells us something pretty interesting. Firstly, in terms of steel consumption per capita, China is already double that of the U.S., ahead of the U.S. already. Bank loans to GDP, China is ahead of the U.S. The key reason is because U.S. use much more capital market and China is very much relying on banking system. But you know, on the other hand, before I did the exercise, I don't know, passenger car penetration of China right now, despite China is already the world's biggest car market, passenger car penetration in China right now is actually the level of U.S. in 1927. It's pretty low, really low. I don't think China will ever go to the level of U.S. because of this has a lot of things to do with how you structure cities, but it's still very small. So anyway, this is how we plot this line. Now the curve actually has no meaning. I just plot something there. Actually, it's only the data point has meaning. To give you an idea, that curve. Now okay, based on this, our analysts, based on some of these kind of things, we had made some projection of the size of different markets in China. The blue one is the Chinese economy. We will expect it to be around double in the next 5 years to 75 trillion renminbi. Well, it's talking about the size of the Chinese economy at that time is already comparable to the U.S. economy in U.S. dollar terms right now. So it's pretty big. At the same time, some sectors will grow slower than the GDP growth. For example, like commodity consumption, we will expect it to grow slower than that of GDP because, in terms of consuming commodities, China actually is already quite ahead of the developed world in a way. In contrast, more consumer related items like e-commerce, we will expect them to grow pretty fast. My U.S. colleague and the Asian colleague agrees that by 2015, China's e-commerce market may be comparable to that of the U.S. That's what they think. And also, apart from consumption, you also see another group of variables which rank very high here are the non-bank financial variables. Like, for example, outstanding corporate bonds, like insurance premium, wealth under management. Because we think another major trend in China in the next couple of years will be financial disintermediation, which we will explain to you in more details later. Anyway, coming to because of this, how we project the economy, we think there are three major structural themes in China, which has some sector implication. The first one, as you would expect, is consumption. I think it's very difficult these days if you find one stock market strategist or economist saying that he is bearish on Chinese consumption in 5 years. You can't find one of them. Everybody is bullish. So I'm not particularly abnormal here. Second one actually is we expect actually indeed the domestic investment growth in China will not be that weak. And we think that machinery exports to emerging market will be a very new development theme out of China. And the third theme I will highlight, as I mentioned earlier, is financial disintermediation. Okay, for consumption, let me draw some data which is based on a China Consumer Survey, which we did every year. And the last survey we did is in the end of last year. Within China, we interviewed about 3,000 people in 10 cities. Well, some of them you are very familiar, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, these are the tier one cities. And CD is Chengdu, WH Wuhan, this is the provincial capital, the inland provincial capitals. And we also do the survey in five relatively small cities, Baoji, Shangfan, some of these names, Handan, some of these names. But the interesting thing is that, to start with, based on our survey, most of the cities are expecting income growth of the coming year. That means this year, better than last year. And second is that the expectation of income growth are strongest, not in the tier one cities, not in the tier two cities, actually in the smaller cities. It seems that a lot of consumer goods companies these days are telling you that increasingly the demand for their product is shifting down to the lower tier cities. I think this is a pretty interesting trend to observe. And second is that apart from rising consumption, I think pretty fair to say that the actual rise in China is discretionary consumption. Because in our consumer survey, this is very, very clear that the percentage of income spending on food is clearly so a declining trend with your income growth. So that means, what it means is that when Chinese income continue to grow, you will start to see them, they will consume more, but they also will shift from more basic food consumption to more discretionary consumption. Okay, sometimes the food consumption itself should also need to be redefined because some foods are very basic, some foods actually are quite discretionary. You probably will see within the food sector, they also will migrate to more discretionary type of consumption. And I think in the stock market, the weighting of consumer sector will also rise in China. Okay, I skip it. Another major theme, as I mentioned, is the relocation of production inland. As you can see, in terms of disposable income, the second tier cities are still about 1,000 renminbi lower than the developed part. And I think you will probably see the blue provinces migrating to red provinces in terms of industry relocation. These blue provinces, these four of them actually account for 70% of Chinese export and 30% of its GDP. And I think you will probably see a lot of industry migration. And if you look at these red provinces, generally speaking, their per capita fixed capital are much lower, their capital base are much lower than the developed part of China. So this will be a major source of investment spending. Indeed, when you go to the inland provinces in China, their desire to build things are still very strong. This is one key reason why we don't think Chinese investment growth will slow too much. And also, we think that China will also be a major beneficiary of the industrialization process, a heavy industrialization process of places like ASEAN, South America, etc. Their investment rates are rather low, and when they start the investment process, as China did in 20 years ago, Chinese and Korean machineries seem to be a very competitive forces there. Now, why I said earlier, why I think that there is a strong case, why we expect non-bank financial institutions will grow fastest. At the moment, 80% of domestic funding within China comes from banks, within which five banks, the big four banks plus China Development account for half of total loans issued. So you can see how concentrated is the risk of China's financial system, concentrated in a few financial institutions. So I think the development of the bond market and the financial disintermediation is going to be a very key policy initiative in the next couple of years. Okay, my last slide. What could go wrong? I think a large part of my story is actually the industry relocation from the coastal province into the inland. This is a major driver, this is a major force that could drive the wage growth in the inland provinces. However, for this process to continue, you need the wage growth in the developed China coastal region also growing very strongly. Now, for the coastal region, that could raise the questions. You could push out Foxconn, but what to replace with it? Whether you can upgrade your industrial sector to maintain the high wage growth in the coastal region. So I think next couple of years, if major big coastal provinces like Guangdong, Jiangsu, and Shandong are doing well, China will do well, and vice versa. And secondly, it's whether government can adopt to a different growth model. I will expect the government financing to deteriorate, but how fast and how far? That's the question. And finally is, when you have this kind of shifting growth structure, whether the monetary policy, where the financial system can cope with it. As mentioned, I haven't touched too much on the risks of a financial crisis in China, because I think it has a lot to do with point number one and point number three, whether the productivity gain of the country can continue, and whether the financial system could cope with all these changes. So I stop here. Yeah, sure.
Why don't we open the floor for questions then, and please identify yourself and your organization. Back here in the corner, please. Please wait for the microphone.
Eric Floyd, FCC member. My question really is about if you've given much thought to Hong Kong and how it will develop as a result. Specifically, Hong Kong is a financial center and a logistics center, but we're also a center for factory owners and senior executives who commute to their factories in Guangdong, Pearl River Delta.
Yeah.
What happens if factories move west? Do we stop being as much of a headquarters society, or do they simply manage factories that are farther away?
Well, I think that's a very good question, because frankly speaking, you will only use the ports in Hong Kong if your factory is based in Guangdong. Port and airport for freight traffic. If my factory is in Chongqing, look, I probably will not really use the ports in Hong Kong to ship things out. And even if you need to fly things out from airplane, I will directly fly from Chongqing. So in a way, I think Hong Kong as a transportation center, in the first 20 to 25 years before the mid-90s, before year 2000 of China's economic development, Hong Kong was basically the transportation hub of China. I think this role is declining. The role as a financial center, now put it this way, I think the role of Hong Kong as a wealth management center and a high-end retailing center is probably safest. The fact that a lot of rich people in most emerging markets want to park their money outside their own country, generally speaking, is favorable to Hong Kong. I think this will be a long-term trend. This thing is difficult to really. This part actually are the safest. So indeed, I remember 10 years ago in 2001, 2002, when the whole Hong Kong financial sector was in depression mode. Private banking still increased their hiring, and the shops in Landmark are still full. So I think that two segments seems to be most safe. The question, though, however, right now, I think, which is the most unknown question, is whether Hong Kong's role as the dominant fundraising center for China will start to change. I think that is an important issue. In a way, you could say that given China's capital control, given the limited room for renminbi business in Hong Kong is hindered. Let's be frank, Hong Kong is hindered by it. So I think this position of, but at the same time, Hong Kong is still a preferred destination of listing in China, particularly, okay, for the state-owned enterprises, they need to list both Hong Kong and Shanghai anyway, their employees, so they make their decision based on government rules. But for the private sector, if you look at all the highest ranked consumer goods companies are actually choosing the Hong Kong market to list rather than in mainland China. Hong Kong is still a very attractive fundraising center for private entrepreneurs in mainland China. How long can it last? We don't know. This is, I think, the biggest challenge. I would say if you look at number of Hong Kong's comparative advantage, transportation, we have the weakest comparative advantage. We have the strongest comparative advantage in managing the wealth of rich Chinese, and in being the shopping center for them, fine, we are pretty safe. The middle is the tricky part. The middle potentially the largest, the fundraising part, is the most uncertain. That's how I would put in this case. It doesn't seem Hong Kong will be a big IT center for China. Doesn't look like it at this stage. Doesn't seem to be a major tech center in China. And in the longer run, I think Hong Kong's, the whole economic development probably we'll need to think about the relationship with Shenzhen, because frankly speaking, these two places economically, it's actually look more like one city. But socially, legally, politically, they are very, very different. So these are the kind of challenges.
Okay, next. I think I saw a hand over here. No. Okay, here and then here, please.
Portler and Fargo Group. At the beginning of your speech, you mentioned that the active population in China had sort of reached a plateau and was not expanding anymore. How do you factor in the urbanization factor? Do you assume that the pool of surplus labor in rural China has been exhausted and that the Lewisian turning point has been reached already?
Now, put it this way. There will always be some rural community which you don't see people moving out to work, or you take a very long time for them to move out to work. For example, in the mountainous region in the west, there are still quite some labor there, but it's very difficult for this group of people to go out. But I had a discussion with a lot of demographic experts in China. They say that if you look at the province in which you are easy to get the rural workers from, like Hunan, like Sichuan, basically a lot of them has already moved out. The easy parts, those that are close to the to your production base and also are more, because if you are really living in a mountainous region, you don't really know what happens in the outside. It's a little bit difficult for them to move, to migrate out. But anyway, I will say that the nowadays you see a different trend. Is that in the past the factories are put in the coastal region and ask people to come. Okay, it seems now people are not willing to come. So I moved the factory to close to your home, and then you're willing to come out to work. To a certain extent, I think it helps. It helps. But I think this picture basically tells you that in absolute basis, most importantly is that you could squeeze some labor out by two things, by delaying the retirement age and by moving the industry in the inland. But if you take in a 5 to 10 years perspective, I think it's pretty difficult to cover a 60 to 80 million deficit gap. It will be increasingly difficult. So I think this is actually what you asked is actually a very hot debate in China right now. Even within the intellectuals and the government officials, they don't have a common opinion on it. I tend to agree that at least a certain level of plateau has already reached in terms of the labor force supply. To get the remaining labor force out, the cost in terms of training, all this kind of thing, might be increasingly large.
Okay, back here in the corner.
Joseph Cheney from Thomson Reuters. There's a lot of speculation that the statistics that are released by the government are untrustworthy, and that they're massaged to accommodate political targets. How much do you trust the statistics coming out of the Chinese government, and how does that factor into your analysis of China?
Well, very good question. Generally speaking, the funniest part is that we usually will need to start with the statistics which we don't believe the most, which is GDP. The good news, though, however, is that nominal GDP is better than real GDP. Now, my rule of thumb is very simple. I don't care whether a statistic number is growing very fast or growing very slowly. What I care about is whether they have volatility. I don't believe in any economy without volatility. If you look at real GDP growth in China, you never see volatility. The biggest volatility is first quarter 2009, 6% real growth. That is the lowest point. And the highest point is maybe 12-13%. That is an issue. And indeed, when you talk about real GDP, is always very simple. When we always talk about real GDP, but real GDP by itself is a very theoretical construct. We don't know. Indeed, we don't know real GDP in any part of the world. Real GDP is we count everything and then we divide by deflator, and that deflator is, well, say it lightly, very problematic. Okay. But anyway, nominal GDP, at least it fluctuates. It fluctuates between 5%, between 3% to 17-18%. Okay, then at least this number seems to have some ground. But generally speaking, this is also not a high quality number, because very simple, you add up all the provincial GDP, it's very, very different from the national GDP. One of them must be wrong somehow. Generally speaking, the tendency for real GDP is that local government had a tendency to underreport the growth when the growth is really strong, and overreport the growth when the growth is very weak. That is usually the tendency. Now, some of the data, relatively speaking, are much easier to use. Export. Export is a, because Chinese exports to any countries and other countries import from China, you always can balance it out. To a certain extent, money supply also is a better quality number because somehow you can balance. Electricity output is a very good number because you can't hide. So, yes, you are right. We somehow can only paint a certain picture. Because there are a lot of, in general, put it this way, because my skepticism towards statistics is way beyond China already. I don't know whether CPI is a good measure of inflation in the last 10 years in the world. I think the world's inflation in 5 years go much higher than the US GDP suggests, US CPI suggests. This is, but anyway, no matter what, we somehow have to live with a certain thing. So we try to paint a picture. It's just roughly, in a way, it's basically like an impressionist painting, but we just pretend it to be a realistic painting.
We barely have time for one last question, but it would have to be really quick. Or maybe we leave on the, oh yes, okay. After impressionistic paintings, we get one more question.
I've got a hard one, but an easy one. Do you have a downside scenario? What are the challenges to the scenario you've just painted?
Yeah. Well, the worst case scenario is a financial crisis. Very simple. Once you have a financial crisis, you basically talk away growth. Growth will disappear. All the talk about 7 or 8% growth becomes meaningless when you have a financial crisis. The question is, it's pretty difficult to predict a financial crisis. You only know whether things are going wrong or going right. There are always a lot of things going wrong in China. No hiding this point. Overinvestment, irrational investment, particularly on the investment side, careless banking, you name it. But on the other hand, you also see some pretty positive force. Now, the most positive force I will highlight to you is not so much on the GDP number, real growth, is that in last 10 years, if you compare in the 90s and the first 10 years of the China stock market, in the 90s, we don't really see one good company come over in China. I remember in 1997, after the financial crisis, when I look at China, and what are the biggest companies in China? Shanghai Industrial and Shanghai Petrochemical. Well, then you know that you have a problem. Then in the last 10 years, you genuinely, okay, I exclude all those PetroChina, those big state enterprises, because they are created by the government. You look at a lot of private companies coming out, widely innovative. Okay, they may copy from somewhere else, but at least they know how to copy and make it work. You see that people will have some business model, new business come along. You can say that in a Schumpeter terms, a lot of new men comes over in China in the last 10 years. I think this is critical. If you continue to see real men, new companies, new IPO that are interesting, I think the economy is safer. But once you see this process stop, and in particular, if you see the big coastal economy, like Guangdong, runs into trouble, then China will be very risky. That will be the down. That will be the downside. The whole thing at the end of the day is productivity gain. Because if you have productivity gain, you have economic growth, then you have tax income growth, and the government, okay, the project, me may be a highway to nowhere, doesn't matter. The guy has enough tax income to pay for it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We like to give all of our guests something to remember the club by.
Oh, thank you.
And we hope to see all of you again here soon, including next Wednesday's speech later lecture. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.